Hi, welcome to the Artificial Intelligence, Machine Learning and Data Science Weekly Podcast. My name is Kwan Hong, or you can call me KH. In this show, I'll be talking to AI, ML and data science practitioners around the region. In each episode, I will dive into relevant and interesting AI, ML topics, where you get to know more about topics ranging from AI, ML adoption, best practices, and tips and tricks to be a better AI, ML data science practitioner. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of AI, ML, and Data Talk podcast. In today's episode, I'm super excited to have Jason Mayers, who's currently working as a web ML lead at Google, as a guest for the show. Hi, Jason. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here today.
Since you are on a tour of the DevFest, I think I managed to catch you to become one of the guests for my show. So welcome to the show again. So as the flow of my show, usually I ask the guests to actually do a self-introduction about themselves. Maybe you can start to give us a brief background about your childhood or maybe your education your current career path that leads you to become a web ML at least.
Okay. Okay, it's quite a journey. So let's get started. So I grew up in England, and I grew up in a very simple family back there. So before I even knew about technology, I wanted to be in the Air Force back in the old days. So unfortunately, that didn't quite work out due to medical reasons and things like this. So my uncle bought me my first laptop when I was around 12 or 14, something like this. And I started learning how to program in Visual Basic. And this gave me superpowers back then because I could make the computer do what I wanted it to do and get it to respond in certain ways or call some API. And that triggered my inspiration to go deeper into technology, essentially. So I took a gap year to earn some money, and then I sent myself to university after that. I went to University of Bristol and studied computer science. It's here that I realized that I couldn't program well, and I learned properly how to program at this point, so learn the basics of languages like C, Java, JavaScript, and a few others as well. And I also realized that even if you make the best back-end service without a good front-end and UX user experience, people won't use it. So I became very passionate about web technologies because it allowed me to do the back-end tech algorithms and databases and all that kind of fun stuff, but also mix it with the user experience and user interaction and all that kind of stuff, so the design aspects. So web engineering became my passion, if you will, and I actually joined a startup called Exmos, which was a semiconductor company. I led their web engineering for 3 years, and I wore many hats there. I highly recommend trying out startups early in your career. You get to wear many different hats. I did coding, design, UX, even photography and 3D modeling, all this kind of stuff. And eventually I realized it was time to start my own company. So alongside that job, so 9 to 5, I did the Exmos job. And then 5 to 11, I did my own startup company, which is a web agency of sorts, with myself and a co-founder. And over the course of a year, I built up a decent reputation that we're getting work coming in, and it was taking off quite nicely. But also at that point, Google then found me because of this success and were asking me to join them as a web engineer at Google London. So I put my startup on hold and I joined Google 12 and a half years ago now. And I was a web engineer. And I learned how to do all the scalable systems on the Google Cloud, and learned about security and all that kind of fun stuff too. And I realized the thing that really got me up in the morning on Monday mornings was starting with a blank canvas and solving a problem that hadn't been solved before. So at Google, we have this thing called 20% projects, where you can take one day a week to kind of follow your passions and learn something new or things along those lines. And it was in these 20% times I was making these fun projects that were world first in the web industry. And I became known for that internally. So I then joined a team over in California called The Zoo. And they were like a creative think tank inside of Google to make world first for our largest customers globally. So I got to use all those skills I learned before to apply to that kind of realm. And that's where I got into machine learning and more emerging technologies, because we had to like work with those emerging technologies to tell the story of our customers in some novel way. So maybe there's a new Hollywood movie for Star Wars or something. I might propose having a life-size stormtrooper with projection mapping, which is hooked up into our speech recognition APIs and natural language processing, to then allow people to talk to it at a red carpet event and get answers about the Star Wars universe or something like that. So we come up with his ideas. And that's when I realized I got into machine learning, because I was trying to solve a problem where I was trying to recognize Red Bull cans and regular computer vision just wasn't cutting it. So back in 2015, just before TensorFlow was announced to the public, I was able to try it internally. And that's when I had my first taste of proper machine learning to do image classification. And I found out it was really hard to solve this, even with all the knowledge I had around me of the people who made TensorFlow. It was still really hard to use at that time. So I took it upon myself to take this knowledge I'd learned from my Google peers and make a system that was easy to use. I called this ZooML back in the day, which is a zoo machine learning technology. And what I allowed it to do is you upload a video of some object that you're interested in. And I would then process that with the TensorFlow library and produce a model that could then recognize that object via a JavaScript API. So you send me an image, I'll tell you if it's in the image or not. That went on to become Cloud Auto ML Vision. and that's when I realized I want to do more of that kind of stuff, make stuff easy for everyone to use. And it so happened in 2020, the TensorFlow.js team was looking for someone with a background in web engineering, which is what I had, and a passion for machine learning, which I was starting to get. So I then was able to combine my two sides of the coin there to become developer relations engineer for TensorFlow.js. And that's where I am today. So, yeah.
Wow, interesting journey indeed. So I think, like you mentioned, I'm sure a lot of people have heard of TensorFlow, which is one of the most popular deep learning framework out there. But then you were saying that there's something called TensorFlow.js.
Yes.
How does the TensorFlow.js is different from TensorFlow, actually?
Great question. So as many of you have heard, there's Python TensorFlow out there that came out there first in 2016 or 2015. Shortly afterwards, we created TensorFlow.js, which is the same library, but written in JavaScript, so that JavaScript users can actually benefit from this ecosystem too. Because traditionally, machine learning has been a very Python-focused area because of academia, but 70% of the world use JavaScript. So we realized there's a missing gap there. So some researchers at Google created this to, at first, put models onto the browser to, for people to try and understand how machine learning works. But it turned out people found this really useful, and it actually then graduated to a fully-fledged product on its own. So, yeah.
So... because we also know there's something what we call on-device machine learning.
Yes.
So I think there's a lot of people are very excited to actually deploy the project at the edge computing. So does the TensorFlow allow people to do that also? Because if it just can run on a web browser, then we can actually definitely run on the edge devices.
Correct, yes. So TensorFlow.js is an interesting one. We've got two incarnations of it. There's the Node.js version, which is just like Python on the server side. And then we've got the JavaScript version that runs locally on the client side. So by running locally, that gives you the privacy, it gives you low latency, and of course, lower cost because there's no cloud GPUs for the inference being used. So those are our superpowers by running on the client side, yes.
Yeah. So I'm sure a lot of people have seen Jason promoting TensorFlow.js project over the internet. And then you have a lot of interviewed many people, many developers actually showcase their TensorFlow project, TensorFlow.js projects.
Yes.
Any project that that actually blow your mind when you see it that you still remember until today?
I think all the projects have blown my mind over the years as they keep coming out better and better things. But one application that I particularly like is the application of TensorFlow.js in the healthcare industry. There's one company called Include Health that does remote physiotherapy using our pose estimation models. So with nothing more than your regular webcam in the browser, you're able to understand the 3D pose of the human to understand for physiotherapy the range of motion and all this kind of stuff. So now people who might find it hard to get to a doctor, especially when you've got physical issues with your body, can actually do it from the comfort of their house in a privacy-preserving way, and the aggregate results of the range of motion are sent to the doctor rather than the raw imagery necessarily. So their privacy is preserved as well. So this is a very interesting use case, and I think we'll see more of those happening into the future too.
Talking about the post-estimation model, there's a lot of people actually use the model to actually do a lot of stuff. For example, how to play golf, how to have a proper yoga pose. And recently there's a lot of projects that actually incorporate other libraries, for example, the MediaPipe libraries.
Yes.
Maybe can you elaborate more on
that? Sure, yes. So alongside TensorFlow.js, there's also a team at Google called MediaPipe, and they're most famously known for their body based models. So things like face key point detection or pose estimation or body segmentation, those are the most popular models probably. So they're all about understanding the human body in some shape or form for multimedia applications. And their team has worked closely with the TensorFlow.js team in the past to port some of their models to run in the browser as well. So many of those models can now run in the JavaScript environment by technologies like web GPU or WebAssembly to get really fast performance in the browser.
Okay. So where do you see the next trend or the next upcoming things that can be done with TensorFlow.js or MediaPipe?
So we're starting to see in 2023 the Gen AI stuff being pushed to the client side as well. About a year and a half ago, I saw the first version of a diffusion model being run entirely in the web browser. Of course, you do need a large graphics card to do that. But if you have one on your machine, then you can run it locally, which is really cool. And we're starting to see the same pattern happen with the large language models as well. Obviously, the very large language models, you're going to need a very high spec machine to do that. But I think we're starting to see a trend of shrinking these models down. So everyone got excited initially, like, how large can we make these things? But now people are trying to figure out what's the minimum I need for a certain business application. And of course, in the real world, when you're trying to make a profit and make money, you want to be efficient and not waste a lot of money on the cloud services to run those LLMs. So I think we'll see a trend of these being made or distilled, if you will, for certain subject areas, maybe like legal document summarization or code generation or things like this. And these individual models will be downloaded as they're needed and cached locally to then perform a task for that user on that website. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there was a time where people all rushed to actually build larger model with more parameters and train larger model. But soon they realized that actually now they try to condense the model. They find that actually if you have a condensed model with a lesser parameter, it actually performs reasonably well also. I think that's the thing that people are trying to do, how to actually push a model that actually lesser parameter, but perform reasonably well also.
Yeah. And I think that's like a wise thing to do generally with machine learning. I see a lot of people ask me where they're saying, should I use machine learning or regular computer science? And I say, well, if machine learning actually gives you a significant edge over the regular computer vision techniques, then use it, you know, because explainability is obviously better as well. So, and the same applies to these LLMs and things. Having a smaller, more concise model is probably better for many reasons than to just have the biggest thing that's maybe good at everything, but you're only leveraging a small part of it really in day-to-day usage. So,
very interesting. So talking about LLM, I'm sure that a lot of people are very curious as to how does the LLM is going to affect the work as a data scientist or machine learning engineer or AI scientist. Because people are saying that now we have all these GitHub Copilot or Duet AI or whatever LLM AI assistant model out there that can actually help us to do programming and they were saying that sooner or later they might not need to be a job as a programmer.
Sure.
Where do you see this trend?
So I would disagree with that in the near term future until we have like AGI or something like that. I think right now it's good as a co-pilot. So if you're stuck on something, it can give you a suggestion that may or may not be right, but you as a human can look at that and maybe get some inspiration from it. So using LLMs or even diffusion models for inspiration in your work, I think is the sweet spot right now. Completely relying on it, I personally would not do that. If you look at some of the code it produces, it might be functionally correct, but it might be not very efficient or not very easy to understand or read. So there's other aspects of software engineering that it doesn't quite get right now. And even if it does, it could hallucinate answers as well, which might not be correct, technically speaking. So I think as a means for inspiration is the best place for it at this point in time. Yeah.
Okay. So to all the people who are worried, it's not that bad yet. So I think another thing that always boggles my mind is, so we know that large language model is trained a large amount of data that's available out there. But now with large language model, it also generates a lot of data.
Yes.
So do you see there is a vicious cycle where generated data, which is not correct, like you say, hallucination by all these large language model, is going to be feedback into the model again and going through all this process again?
That's definitely a possibility. And I'd also argue that a lot of humans are incorrect most of the time as well. So I think we're no better off than we were before in that sense. We've just got more of this stuff being generated. and at a faster rate. And I think this is a general trend in human history, is that we're producing more data than ever before. And it's going to be more important for companies like Google, in fact, to try and fact check this stuff to make sure it is accurate as the best we can. So I think we'll see more research going on in those areas into the not too distant future, to try and make sure that the stuff it's coming back with actually can be verified with a trusted source, but it is probably true and is not just hallucinated in some form. Yeah.
So basically, in a way that more research needs to be done, therefore there's a more opening or job opportunity for people to do computer science or machine learning works related to large language model.
Yeah.
Okay. So the next thing is anything that you are passionate outside of your work, actually, we would like to find out more.
Outside of my work.
because I see from your profile, you call yourself as a hybrid developer design technologies. What does that mean, actually?
Yes. So I've always been a strong believer that in order to innovate, you need to cross multiple industries and take inspiration from many areas, right? So I've always defined myself on my website. If you look at my website currently, at least, it says I'm 51% technical and 49% creative. So I've got a slight bias to the technical side, being an engineer, but I also do appreciate the design and UX aspects as well. So I've always tried to blend those two things in anything I create. So I won't just make research for the sake of research. I'll try and solve some problem or make something more efficient than it was before. So it has some business value or value to human life or something like that. I see a lot of research going on these days, but it's just for the sake of research rather than actually getting at something. So I've always had that spin on things. And I think if you're looking to stand out in the crowd as well, it's good to be a hybrid of two industries. So maybe you're interested in music, but you've got a passion for machine learning, then focus on machine learning for music or something like this. And you'll be able to find a niche for yourself where the job you're doing isn't a job because it's just play to you, right? And it might take a few years to get to that spot, to get to that perfect role. But if you aim for that, I think that's a good thing to do, because then, I don't work a day in my life right now. I'm here talking to you on a podcast, and this is part of my role now, which is awesome. So, but I also get to play with a lot of new technologies and experiment and innovate. So innovation is one of my side hobbies, I guess. I love to make things in my spare time. Sometimes I have coding dreams, and I'll code something in my mind when I'm dreaming, and then over the weekend, I'll actually just implement it and it works, which is cool. So,
well, you mean you in your dreams, you do coding?
Yes, it happens.
Wow. So, oh, it's something. Do you debug codes during your dream?
Sometimes I come up with my solutions like that. So there's one situation where I was trying to make this teleportation demo where I was able to teleport myself using WebXR and body segmentation and other things, WebRTC, that kind of stuff. And I got stuck on some problem when I was making this, but after dreaming about it for a little bit, I actually came up with a solution, and then I actually tried it out on the weekend, and it actually solved the problem. So, so it's cool. The subconscious can work in mysterious ways sometimes. So,
that means your mind has no rest during when you are sleeping.
Your subconscious mind
is actually still doing a lot of coding work. So, I'm sure that you have deal with a lot of people working in machine learning projects, and also coming to the part where the deployment of the machine learning project. What do you think is the biggest challenges or that people will face when they want to deploy a machine learning project?
Sure. Of course, it changes from person to person, but the main common themes I see are, how do you scale? So a research project might be you and 10 teammates, but how do you scale to tens of thousands of people in a way that is cost-effective? And obviously some of the solutions on Google Cloud can help with this by using like TPUs or something if you are on the server side to reduce the costs a little bit there. But also security as well. I see a lot of people who are early in their careers make web services and things that are very easy to hack. And obviously this comes with experience. You learn how to adapt and prevent these things in the future. But I think having more services that allow you to deploy in a single click that solve these problems for you will help these people out. And there's whole industries working on that right now to make machine learning models one-click deployable so that you don't have to worry about scalability and security, and it just solves all that headache for you. So I think there'll be an ongoing research there. But it's good to know about yourself, because you can also save money by not using those services and doing it yourself sometimes too. So, yeah.
So coming from an academician background, so I've seen that like Malaysia, we just started offering data science and machine learning courses in the universities.
Yeah.
So when you talk about all these problems like scaling, whatever, it's kind of a very practical problem, but it's very hard to actually explain this problem theoretically in the universities. So do you see that for UCT program, whatever, they need to be more connected to the industry so they can actually showcase all this relevant problem that the student might need to know? Because if I'm just studying from textbook, I might not able to see all these problems.
Sure. That's a very good point. One thing I really liked about my degree course when I did computer science is that they forced us to turn our research into a business. Even I did not study business in computer science. I did pure computer science. Mm-hmm. But we had to make a business plan, and we had to make a fully working product that, you know, theoretically could scale and all this kind of stuff. So at first I was like, why are you making us do this? But I can't thank them enough now later in my career, because that actually is very valuable knowledge to have. And Bristol University at the time had some of the most highest number of startups being formed because of this extra element they had in their degree courses. And I think it's important for academic institutions to realize that a lot of people will not stay in academia. They'll go on to regular real world jobs rather than just staying in academia. And there's other problems that must be solved there, or at least known about, in order to be successful in that environment. So I agree with you. Yes, I think they should teach these things alongside, this is how you make a great machine learning model, but this is also how you deploy it at scale. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, interesting. Because a lot of time, coming from academician, a lot of academician, they are very, I would say, perfectionists. They like to come up with a perfect model.
Yes.
But actually, in the real world, deploying a model, making the model work, and making the ROI of the model is more important. So I think if any students or whoever coming to the industry, if they have some business sense, like what you're saying, then how does a model actually benefit the company? That's very important. Because no point spending a lot of time where the model is still being researched and it's not deployed. Till then, the model is not being utilized, and there's no benefit being actually brought into the company.
Sure, yeah. And I think we see this a lot in business, in the business world over the years. Like, many very intelligent people come up with a piece of research but don't see the business potential, and it sits on a research shelf for many years. And then someone like a Steve Jobs of the world sees that research and just changes it slightly into a more form that people can understand and use, maybe adds it with a better UX or design, and then you got yourself the next iPhone or something, right? So I think it's important to not miss those opportunities. If you just go the extra mile and think about these other things like UX and design and the business application and how and why it solves a problem for someone, more people have that chance of being successful than as well, I think. So yeah,
interesting, because you are very focused on the UX and UI, the interface and user experience. Do you see that being a computer science or machine learning or AI scientist nowadays, the experience itself that the product being deployed is also quite important, or should I say it's actually quite important?
Yeah, I think so. And this is one of the reasons this year we launched a product called Visual Blocks ML, which is a low-code drag-and-drop interface for using machine learning models and connecting them to various sensors and outputs, so you can go from idea to production faster. And this actually won some awards at the CHI conference for HCI. And the reason I bring this up is that a lot of research models just sit on the shelves, and that's why we made this product. So more of this research can get into the hands of people to try out and experiment with and then innovate. So I see a lot of great research written up in research papers, but very hard for the average person to understand, even though the average person might know, I need a segmentation model. So they know what they want, but they look at the research paper, they have no idea like what that actually means, but they just want to be able to take it and try it out. So if you can enable that for people, I think we'll see a lot more innovation happen within society, generally speaking. And you can like take model A from person B and get person C's model and combine them together to do something even better than they could individually. So I hope more of that happens organically in the future. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing that I like about Google. Google has a lot of things that actually can be used and deployed can be prototyped very fast. For example, with Google Colab, you can actually try out a Python code just using a browser.
Yes. Yeah.
Or now we have this Visual Block, we can actually try out building some simple prototype just by dragging and drop. Yeah. Then like now with large language model, Google has Maker Suite where you can actually prototype a large language model.
Yes, that's right.
Easily as soon as possible. Now even Google has a Project IDX where you are allowed to actually code similar like Visual Code, VS Code, but just using the browser.
Exactly. And all of these themes, the common theme between them is the ease of use. And the same for Google itself. When we, before Google Search, there was Yahoo Search and Ask Jeeves and Alta Vista. But the thing that made Google popular was its ease of use. One simple text box, you put what you want and magically come back the answers, right? So it always comes back to UX and understanding the human in the loop there in order to be successful. Yeah.
So do you think that for any of this computer science, data science, they should also introduce a subject, at least a student must know UI, UX?
I mean... Some people are just not interested in that aspect, and that's fine, but they should at least
know about it.
They should be aware of that this exists, and even if they don't want to do it, they should maybe loop someone in who does know about it to help them polish up their final API or whatever they're exposing to the world to have the best chance of it getting used by people, I guess. So I think that would be good to have. Maybe the computer science department can collaborate with the UX and design departments to work together on at least one project so they understand how to work together better in the future.
So I see this thing that people are missing out a lot, especially because I've been the judges of a lot of hackathons.
Yes.
Mm. Or even when I see people pitch for a startup. So a lot of time people if I'm a pure technologist, I'll focus more on the model, talking about model. But when people look at the product and look at the UI, UX, you know, how does the product make me feel good?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if I'm not presenting a good product that make me feel good, no matter how good is technology behind, I might not want to use it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that's something that's always lacking. So I see that the people who actually want hackathon or people who want pitching to get funding for any startup, these UI, UX components usually are lacking actually most of the time.
Yeah. And I think this also comes from my own personal experience where I've been both a back-end engineer and a front-end engineer. And I made some very complex things that solve some hairy problems on the back-end. And you get like a yes come out on the command line and you're very proud of yourself. But the end user doesn't care. What they see is like the button change on the UX and that, oh, wow, you made progress. I was like, okay. And that's when I realized myself that these things matter just as much as the backend. Yeah. So, yeah.
Okay. So how do you see, let's say I would want to, because nowadays we have, we are in this DevFest season now. So for our listener out there, Google has an annual event where, we have a big event where we have invite speakers to actually share the latest technology to our audience, which is DevFest. So Jason actually came to Malaysia to become a speaker for DevFest Kuala Lumpur and DevFest Georgetown.
Yes.
Do you see that attendees like this benefit from this event? And then how do you think that, what kind of takeaway that a student will attend for all this event, what kind of takeaway that they should go back and think about from all these events?
So I just finished one talk in Malaysia so far here in Kuala Lumpur. So the feedback so far has been pretty positive from the people who added me on LinkedIn and sent me some feedback. So a lot of people are very thankful that they were able to realize Web AI existed. It is quite new versus the traditional Python approach. So I think people just didn't know it existed before. So and that's my job, to go out and tell people it exists and to go try it. So my hope is that they will go and try it afterwards, not just attend the talk, but play with it a little bit and see if anything that I said in the talk might be useful to help solve the problems they're dealing with in their, maybe their personal lives or even their startups or companies that they work for. See if they can apply any of that to those situations. And if just a few of those people manage to, I think that's a good success and we might see some great stories come from that. Yeah. And maybe they'll be on my show and tell in the future on YouTube.
That should be interesting. So basically, I think all the DevFest attendees, because the topic is so vast, there are so many topics that have been discussed in that DevFest event. Like for example, in the DevFest Kuala Lumpur, I think we have around 30 speakers. So the topic is so vast, but I think the students, the attendees attended the event, what the main thing is,
that hopefully they will learn some new technology and go back, be excited about it, and then be curious about it and go back and try something out. And then hopefully we our mission is done. Then we're able to, you know, give them this opportunity to learn something new and go back and try something else.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely.
So coming to the advice of, because you coming from a background of a computer science student, but then you actually went and do your own startup and then you joined Google. So you have seen, you have started your own company, you also joined Google. If I were to join, if I were to be interested in data science now, or I'm not in the computer science industry or from the background, so where do I get myself started? How do I, how do I get myself into this industry?
Yeah, great question. So obviously, depending on your skills and expertise, you might start in different areas, but generally speaking, you've got to just start somewhere. The hardest thing is to get going, get some momentum going. And, you know, if you start at the very low level straight away, you might start crying because of all the mathematics and things involved in machine learning, but you don't have to start at that level. You can start high up, maybe find a model that interests you, like the LLMs or a pose estimation model, and just play with it on a high level. Just use it as a black box and understand the limitations of that model and try and apply it to some situation you want to solve. Once you've done that a few times, you can then start peeling back the layers to see, okay, how does that model actually work? What makes up that model? You might find there's actually several models contained in one model in order to make it work properly. And then that sends you down a rabbit hole of learning, essentially. And you can then start to specialize in one area. So maybe you're more on the vision side, so you specialize in computer vision models, or maybe you want to do the natural language stuff. You know, the choice is yours, but go wide first, see what's there, pick a few models that you like the sound of and might be useful in your industry or career, and then go deeper and refine your skills in that area. But the main thing throughout all of this is to keep producing interesting pieces of work that showcase your ability to use these things. Because if you don't do that, no one knows how good you are at that, especially if you don't have a degree in that subject. So you need to prove that you're as good as someone with a degree in machine learning these days. I mean, machine learning wasn't even a degree back in my day. So I didn't have a machine learning degree. So all I've got going for me is my reputation and the things I've produced over the years to show that I can use machine learning well enough that I am credible to talk about it. So same situation. It takes time to build up that. And one other way you can help build credibility is to use, like, you know, LinkedIn and places like this to talk about the things you found, discuss this with your peers and share other people's work and give your commentary on it. Like, why is it important? How can you other people use this? Show demos that you've created of those APIs that someone else might have made, but you're starting to use those and build your reputation in that area too. I think a lot of kids these days, I see, forget that aspect of business networking. In the business world, at least in America, it's very important to have a strong network. And that can often lead to very cool career opportunities from that. About 5 years after me graduating, no one asked me about my degree anymore. It's all about what's your experience? What did you do? What will you show me your work? That kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I think but I think like anybody who actually learn new things, keeping the momentum is very important.
Yes. Yeah.
Taking the first step is always hard. And then trying to come up with taking the first step and then keeping the momentum. And then there is a showcase point. You know, every time when you know you have achieved something, showcase whatever you have done.
Yeah.
Because when you showcase your product to the people, showcase in the GitHub or write a blog about it or show it in a LinkedIn, whatever, you actually gain some sort of like people who said, okay, they actually kind of like agree that you have done something.
Yeah.
And then also you have probably received comments or criticism.
Yes.
But it's good. But it's good because that will allow you to actually improve further. And then you build on from that, you actually go on and then you improve your skill set along the way.
Exactly.
And I think like what Jason said, networking is very important.
Yes.
So I think a lot of our audience in Malaysia, like students in Malaysia, they are very shy. They are very timid. By joining all these like DevFest event or going for communities event, you know, try to brave up yourself to become a speaker. So when you speak in an event, yes, you actually need to actually prepare yourself. By preparing yourself, and then when you go and give a talk, you actually improve your knowledge. And also you improve your networking skill. People know you better.
100% agree. Yeah. In fact, I think there's a famous thing called the four stages of learning. And the first stage is knowing that you don't know anything and you're seeking advice from experts in the field or reading a book. The second phase is you think you know everything because you read that one book and you get overly confident. The third stage is realizing you're not as confident as you thought you were, and you go through another learning phase essentially to really refine your skills to a higher level. And then the fourth stage is mastery, where you're then teaching yourself. And everything in life goes through these four stages, like learning how to cook or learning how to program. It's the same four stages of development there. And it's very important to recognize when you're at stage two and not stage four, because it's a dangerous place to be. And, you know, myself included, like, we're all human. And when I graduated from university after 4 years of computer science, I thought I knew everything. And of course, my first web service I made got hacked, and I realized, oh no, I need to learn about security and scaling to like tens of thousands of users and all that kind of stuff. And this just comes with experience. It takes many years to gain that experience. It's not something you just learn in a bootcamp. It's just takes time to make 20 projects and go through the nitty gritty of that and have those learnings. You only really learn from failure. So you have to fail a few times to really realize what you're missing. And also when you give a talk, you really better understand what you don't know, because someone will ask you to explain something and it'd be such a simple question at its essence, but you realize you can't answer it in an elegant way. And then you know you need to do some more research and you need to go a bit deeper. And it's okay in those situations to say, I don't know. Don't make stuff up in talks. Just say, I don't know, I'll find out and give you a link later or something. But at least you then progress yourself as well. I think a lot of people these days are scared of saying they don't know. And that's also an important topic to bring up, I think, because it's only by realizing we're stuck or wrong that we can progress as well in terms of innovation or making progress on something. So it's a human trait to want to not say you're wrong, but it's important to realize when you might be. So yeah.
Yeah, I think if you accept that there are a lot of things that you do not know, when you ask, you receive all these questions, it's also good for you to go back and find out more about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So another thing that I see that the current trend is no longer people are doing all this machine learning model training in a local premise. People are all moving to the cloud. Yeah. So do you see that anybody who is working in the current industry now, they at least must have a cloud knowledge or at least know how to use one cloud platform, whether it's GCP or AWS or Azure or whatever?
I mean, in terms of machine learning, I think a lot of the services that machine learning engineers use are these very easy to use interfaces like Google Cloud, which have like AI scalable systems. You just drag your data into a bucket and whip up an instance and go train on it, you know. So a lot of that complexity is done for you. But yes, knowing some cloud service like that is definitely an advantage. If you can go deeper and build your own, then you're even less dependent on one thing. So then if something does get deprecated or something, you can always pivot very fast then too. So, but again, you don't have to learn it straight away. You can start on the high level. And as you go deeper into making your company or business, you start to rewrite layers of that yourself to have it in-house so that you know how to fix it when things go wrong and things like that. So, but yeah, start high and then go lower level as you need to.
Yeah, I think during the beginning time, you can use all the services, but after a while that you realize that you actually incur a lot of costs.
Yes.
You need to optimize your code and then start to deploy your services and then to actually minimize the cost and still make sure the product is still running.
Exactly. And it's not easy to scale things well. There's horizontal scaling, there's vertical scaling, there's all these different ways of doing things, and on the database side, on the statics assets, and there's so many different things you need to scale properly. So I wouldn't just, you know, if you're an ML engineer, I wouldn't just try and solve it on day one, but start to learn these things as you get more advanced, and it can help you in the long term for sure. Yeah.
Okay. So just now you were mentioning about web AI.
Yes.
Okay. Maybe can you elaborate more about that? Because that's something new actually.
Yes. Yeah. So web AI is basically the art of running a machine learning model in the browser on the client side. So once it's downloaded, you don't need a server to do the inference. So right now, TensorFlow.js is one of the popular libraries that enables this. We've also got MediaPipe that have some models that run client-side. And of course, the Chrome APIs themselves, like WebGPU and WebAssembly, are the technologies that power all of these systems to run fast. So the main three technologies are WebGL, WebGPU, and WebAssembly. Yeah, these are the technologies people are using to do that.
So is this something that's a library that I can just call now, or do I need to learn something new stuff?
So the TensorFlow.js library is very similar to Keras. So if you've used Keras on the Python side, we've got almost the same function definitions and everything. So you can create layers models in just a few lines of code, just like you do in Keras, train the model, out pops a trained model. You can then save that somewhere, host it, and then use it in a real web application. So yeah, it's pretty easy to get started with. And I've got a course online that people can take if they're interested in that.
Okay.
So,
yeah. The course is available online?
Yes, it's on Google Developers YouTube channel, goo.gle/learn-webml.
Wow.
And it's probably taking like a week or two to finish it, but there's like 46 videos there. You can go at your own time, and I'll teach you how to use TensorFlow.js, how to use our pre-made models, how to do transfer learning, how to make your own models from scratch from a completely blank canvas, and how to convert from Python to JavaScript as well. So with that knowledge, you can be pretty productive pretty fast and start making things that actually solve problems.
Interesting. Yeah. I will put the link to the show description.
Awesome. Good stuff.
So Jason, is there any interesting books that you read recently?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's, I think my one of my favorite books of recent past is David Eagleman's Incognito, The Secret Life of the Brain. It's actually a book on neuroscience, but I often find myself being inspired by the neuroscience side when I talk and think about machine learning aspects. So that's a great book, and it's very easy to read, but it's got all the scientific papers referenced in the footnotes. If you do want to go deeper and see the more nerdy neuroscience papers, you can. But for people who are not into neuroscience and just want a high-level understanding, it covers a lot of subjects about how the brain works and what you're missing even on a day-to-day basis. Like if you look into a mirror and you watch your eyes move, you don't see them move. You just see the resulting position. So always like fun little facts like this, but get you thinking like, okay, how is our brain actually working? What is it leaving out? What is it including? And it makes you kind of think about how you might apply that to machine learning algorithm or something like this maybe. So I find that kind of stuff interesting to see, to read.
Okay.
Yeah.
So maybe we can actually wrap up. So if I were to be applying for a job,
yes,
for to be a data scientist or machine learning engineer or AI data scientist, what are the tips or tricks that you will give advice to to make sure that they get themselves prepared to at least go through the interview with
sounds
success?
Good. Yeah. Okay. Number one, build your portfolio. Have a strong GitHub presence and a personal website demonstrating your capabilities and what you've made and the impact of that. Not just you made something, but what impact did it have? How many people did it help? How many stars did it get? How many shares on social, that kind of stuff. Show the impact you're having. The second point is, yeah, have a social media impact too. So start your LinkedIn. That's a great way to start networking and allows you to connect with people beyond just your current country as well. People from England, US, France, Germany, Japan, wherever it might be, you can start to network with these people and learn from them. And they might even be inspired by what you're writing. So it goes both ways. I'd say post at least once a week there about something that you've seen that's interesting. And if you've not found something interesting once a week, you're not looking enough, because machine learning is moving so fast, you can definitely find something once a week to post if you really want to. Third thing is, you know, if you don't get that ideal job straight away, don't be put down by that. Like, try the startup lifestyle for a little bit. My personal advice would be, if you're able to, try startups first, and then go to the larger companies later on in your career when you want more stability. When you're younger, you have a chance at least to be a bit more unstable and try things that might just become the next big thing. Do one or two of those. And if it doesn't go anywhere, then go to the big company with all that experience you've just gained and do that. Because it's a lot of fun to wear many hats and get lots of experience early on in your career. And other than that, you know, the only constant in computer science is change. Keep yourself up to date, and you know, you don't have to change. Like, I know there's like, you know, different libraries and frameworks. Like in the web world, there's Angular and there's React and all this kind of stuff. Don't worry about that too much, but just make sure you're up to date with the latest technologies that are coming out, so you know how to pair those technologies with your existing knowledge. So I personally I'm a pure JavaScript guy. I don't use React or Angular, but I know about the other technologies coming out, like the machine learning, the augmented reality and all that kind of stuff. So I can start to pair those with my core JS knowledge to then make things that other people can't. And that allows you to then stand out in the crowd later on. So I think those are my three tips.
I think as I can summarize, basically learning is a lifelong process.
Yes.
Never stop learning. Second thing is marketing is also very important. How you market yourself is very important. I think a lot of people will say that, oh, my code will speak for itself, but it doesn't.
People aren't going to read the code.
You really need to put some effort, no?
Yeah.
And then polish it up and then market yourself properly, whether it's a social media or giving a talk or network yourself, that's also very important.
Very true.
So I think, Jason, thank you very much for your time. I think you have the. I hope that you enjoy your trip in Malaysia. Since you're from KL, you are going to Georgetown, Penang later. So thank you very much for your time. And then hopefully we'll see you again in the near future.
Awesome. Thanks for having me. Cheers.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you would like to help support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review. Follow this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify Podcasts. If you have any comments or recommendations, I would be glad to receive your voice messages. Send me your voice messages via the link in the show notes. To catch all latest episodes, you can follow this show on our website, www.aimldatatalks.com, or our social media such as Instagram or Twitter with the handle @aimldatatalks. Thanks again. I will see you next time.